Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. And greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to the first December issue of X Squared Radio. We're glad you're here with us tonight. The solar wind tonight is 511 kilometers per second and still no sunspots. That's over 300 days without a solar flare and nearly 5 months without a sunspot. There were two sunspot precursors this week from Solar Cycle 24, but scientists are baffled as to why the sun is a no-show. Could the sun be in meditation before the storm predicted by the ancients? We shall see. If the sun awakens like a sleeping giant and heads for its regular pole shift at breakneck speed, or changes its behavior altogether, if it does change, why now? You wouldn't have anything to do with that now, would you? You should know that Cassini teams have been busy observing the moons of Saturn using images from NASA's Cassini probe. Astronomers have already figured out that the mysterious plumes shooting from Enceladus' icy terrain contain water vapor. New calculations suggesting the gas and dust spew at speeds faster than sound make the case for liquid, says lead study author Candace Hansen of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in California. Her team calculated the plumes travel more than 1,360 miles per hour. Reaching that speed is hard to do without liquids, Hansen said. While her paper offers more evidence building on what others have found, she added that her research is not the final proof of liquid water on Enceladus. Other planetary scientists, such as Andrew Ingersoll at the California Institute of Technology, said the research is good, but that it is possible to achieve such speeds with ice particles and at cooler temperatures. So Hansen hasn't proven her case yet. He and others, scientists, are weighing more data to see who is correct. However, Carolyn Porco, the head of the Cassini camera team and astronomer who didn't take part in Hansen's research, said, "The evidence in my mind is building on liquid water. That moon, one of 60 circling Saturn, has become the go-to place for exploration in the outer planets," she said. "Europa, a moon of Jupiter, may have a liquid ocean beneath its frozen surface, but Enceladus, thought responsible for producing one of Saturn's rings, is more accessible," Hansen said. "Enceladus is sort of helpfully spewing out its innards," she said. "Could it be that there is life in these waters? I'll bet we see a mission to Saturn before too long." And if you've been looking at the star recently that is really bright, that light is not a star at all. It's Venus, not Sirius. And the little one next to it is Jupiter. They have been putting on a dazzling show for us last week next to a fingernail moon. Take a look tonight if you get the chance after the program. Our guest tonight is the author of The Afterlife Experiments and the G.O.D., God Experiments, and a professor of psychology, neurology, medicine, psychiatry, and surgery at the University of Arizona. He has put together two of the most compelling scientific experiments on the subjects that science has notoriously got a poor track record with, the afterlife and the existence of God. Get ready to have your mind expanded with our guest, Dr. Gary Schwartz. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to admit, I was cruising through Barnes & Noble and looking in this genre. I found your two books. I scooped them up and read them as though I had never read anything before on the subject, and I was blown away. The detail, the care, and the scientific method that was applied to this more or less allowed me to bring this subject on what's normally a scientific talk radio program. I can tell you you have had a fire to never stop learning and asking questions. At what point in your professional explorations did you find there was something lacking in the traditional consideration of the human being?
Well, that is a great question. I would say that I became awakened to that probably shortly after I got to Yale University, where I was a professor of psychology and psychiatry. This was 1977. And at that time, there was an explosion of discovery in quantum physics and also in astrophysics. And there were two, and physics is a hobby of mine. And one aspect of the physics in terms of our understanding of photons and light was the realization that really struck me that you know, when we look at the sky at night, we see a history of starlight. I mean, we see starlight that's been traveling thousands, millions, or billions of years.
Right.
And astrophysics makes the assumption, in fact, it's the foundation of astrophysics, that light in the, quote, vacuum of space continues more or less unaltered. It retains its information. And that's why we can see distant stars and distant galaxies and so on. That it may be, you know, billions of light years away. And consequently, as you know, a star can come into existence and is emitting light in all directions. I thought it was kind of amusing that you started the show talking about our sun, you know, the star that our planet revolves around. And anyway, that light starts, is transmitted in all directions. And long after the star has, quote, died, that energy and information continues. And it goes on and on and on. And there's therefore an informational record of the history of that starlight. And I realized that our matter and our energy and information is no different than the starlight. It's just much weaker. And so both the visible light and the invisible light and all the radiation that we put off is going out into space as well. And we now know, of course, with contemporary technology and satellites, spy satellites, that literally our visible light and infrared and ultraviolet radiation and so on is, it can all be picked up in space. So our light has a kind of energy and information. Our electromagnetics have a kind of energy and information. And I began to wonder, would our energy and information continue like the light from distant stars? Okay. And if it did, that provided an opening for the possibility, among other things, that the essence of who we are, our energy and information, and matter, as you know, is organized information, could continue after we, quote, physically died. And so that opened me to the possibility of survival of consciousness and life after death. So that was one side of the story. The other side of the story, which gets to the God question, was the realization, and this again was coming from astrophysics, which is what first triggered my thinking about this, was the deeper one looked into space, the more order one discovered. And the level of organization that existed was not only even occurring at the galaxy level, so we see all these spiral galaxies and all these replicated patterns existing everywhere. And we didn't know that these were even distant galaxies until, I don't know, 50, 75 years ago, whenever it was. Anyway, maybe it's sooner. But the critical thing was, on top of that, astrophysicists began discovering patterns among the galaxies, what were called superclusters. And what I realized was there was too much order. Everywhere you looked, from the micro to the macro, we were bumping into order. And the whole notion that that we talk about the second law of thermodynamics and what's happening is that supposedly the universe is becoming more and more, quote, disordered, was actually inconsistent from an informational point of view with everything that we were observing in astrophysics. And when there's too much order, you begin to look for some sort of ordering process, some sort of guiding, organizing, designing process, which again was what opened me to the idea of the possibility of some sort of a universal and if not infinite intelligence. So anyway, so that's where it began. It started with those scientific realizations, and then everything else unfolded from there.
Oh, I understand that. I too looked at the chaos of the universe, and a lot of our listeners do this too, and I've had a couple of very astute listeners come back at me and say, well, you know, you could look at the universe and say, of course, it's full of chaos, it's also full of order, but order survives, and chaos self-annihilates. So order has a natural ability to survive and
That's
to
right.
exist, and so therefore we see it in higher numbers. But then I come back and say, now, wait a minute. You know, bacteria and protozoa and algae far outnumber humans on this planet, and yet they're single cells, completely unorganized, and yet able to adapt to our environment. And here we are, these complex organisms, and we don't survive very well at all without our intelligence or common sense to apply. So, you know, there's also the fact to consider the observation effect. We may not be the only ones observing the universe, and so thus may not be the only ones affecting it from our little pinpoint here on the outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy. There may be even bigger observers going on, thus creating bigger order. And that's what fascinated me about your experiments.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Except the only thing I would qualify is the notion that single-celled organisms are somehow disorganized. It's extraordinarily far, I think, from the reality, because they are so inherently extraordinarily complex.
Sure.
In their organization, that if you were just to calculate the probability of that kind of order occurring by chance is so infinitely tiny, that just the possibility of getting single-celled organisms by chance is unreasonable to assume.
Oh,
that this would occur by chance.
Absolutely. I mean, you run smack into the concept of irreducible complexity.
Right.
That's just no way to organize things on your own. In your book, The Afterlife Experiments, almost at the very beginning, you write about five words that changed your life. Can you tell us about this story?
Sure, I would be happy to. This was involved the first time that I ever met a person who claimed it to be a medium and also who claimed it to be interested in research. And in case your audience is not aware of this, a medium is someone who claims to be able to speak with the deceased, to receive communication from those who have passed on. And I was introduced to a particular medium through I think it was a recently retired psychiatrist. And did not know what to expect. And when I opened the door and I met this woman, the first thing that she said was, your mother's here. And she went on to describe details about my mother in great depth. However, I was not there to get a reading for myself. I was there actually to observe her do a reading with this particular psychiatrist. So I thanked her for the information, but remember, this is the first time that I had met a medium. And of course, my immediate question was, was she engaged in fraud? Had she got this information on the internet or whatever? Then she goes on to say, oh, by the way, your father's here. She then goes on to describe my father and the differences between my father and my mother. And again, she was very accurate. And I again dismissed this. Well, after the spending time with her and other information that I share in the book, by the time I left that meeting, I had a problem because this woman was too accurate and too accurate with things that she wouldn't have known or easily been able to pick up from the internet. And what I did was I called my then research partner who was living in Tucson. I was in LA at the time and returning to Tucson. And I had told this medium nothing about my partner. And I put her on the phone, the medium on the phone, and requested that my partner, talk to her. And the first thing that the medium said was, hello, it's a pleasure to meet you. I've really enjoyed meeting Dr. Schwartz. And she said, I want you to know that your father's here. And he wants me to tell you, thank you for the music. Those were the five words. Thank you for the music. Now, when I heard that, it meant absolutely nothing to me. Like, thank you for the music. What does that mean? Meanwhile, my then partner on the other side of the, on the other island, the end of the phone, was in tears. And I later learned the reason was because her father, my partner's father, had been a distinguished cardiologist. And when he was hospitalized and the physicians thought that he was in a coma, but his partner, his name was Linda, she was not sure about this. And so what she did was she brought a tape recorder, tape player, and a speaker, pillow speakers, for her dying father, and had some of his favorite music played for him. And the only people who knew that she had brought this music was her mother, and some of her sisters and a couple of nurses. And for this medium to get that information, thank you for the music, which was something dearly connected between Linda and her deceased father, because she herself had been a musician and father had loved music, was immediately something that led me to say, something real may be going on here.
Because there was no way that this medium could have gotten this information any other way except for the way she said.
That's correct.
Hmm.
That's correct.
Most interesting. Now, your research partner, was probably a pragmatic and skeptical research partner who really didn't believe in speaking to spirits, right?
Well, I think that she was probably more open to it than I was at the time. But because it was her father, you know, she desperately wanted to know whether it was possible that he was, quote, still here. She was actually trained as a clinical psychologist. I was trained in clinical psychology, too, but I was actually an academic, a researcher, ran a laboratory, and so on. And so when she asked me to help her address this question scientifically, by this point, I had already moved from Yale to the University of Arizona, and it reminded me of my early thinking, you know, when I was at Yale, about quantum physics and light and systems theory and feedback loops and the conditions under which energy and information can both be sustained and grow. And so actually she was one of the people that actually stimulated me to pursue this kind of work. In fact, when people ask me why did I start this work, the soundbite is that I was pushed there by scientific theory and data, but I was pulled there by love, by Linda's love for her deceased father, and then Susie Smith's love for her deceased mother, and then Stardust Johnson's love for her deceased husband. And when you're pushed and pulled in the same direction, it's very hard to resist.
Yeah, I agree with that, totally. You mentioned that you were at Yale. My older brother, Dr. William Scott Agnew, was the dean of physiology at Yale, I think for about 10 years, and then he went ahead and moved on to Johns Hopkins.
When was he there, do you remember?
Yeah, probably mid-70s to about the early 80s.
Well, then we were there at the same time. I was there from 76 to 88.
Right, right. I think he moved to Johns Hopkins in 84 or 85.
Well,
hard for me to keep track of his career, let alone mine. So in this afterlife experiment, it seems like there are three areas of data. One is, of course, the medium themselves, and the other is the sitter, and the other is the control group. And I really want to go, at least in this hour and the portion of the next, into those three areas so that our listeners, you know, won't think that we've gone completely off the spiritual deep end here.
Okay.
A medium, at least as far as abilities, is a little like the difference between, you know, an NBA basketball star and someone on the second string high school basketball team, as far as abilities to at least make functional their communication with the other side, let's call it. Now, when a medium opens up the channel, so to speak, describe your observation of the person while the connection is being made. I mean, do they seem possessed, or do they look, you know, sort of past the room, or do they become emotionally altered in some way? What actually happens to the medium when they make a connection?
Sure, good question. By the way, you want to know something? I have been doing radio shows and television shows since the late 1990s and early 2000s. On the afterlife experiment, and then my subsequent book called The Truth About Medium in this particular area. And would you believe in those hundreds of media events, no one has asked me that question.
Wow, that's really great. So I'm on the right track, or I'm way out in left field here.
Well, I must also tell you that it's not every day that I get interviewed by someone, and I understand that you have I didn't actually look up your background, but I understand you've got scientific training. If I remember, you have a PhD. I mean, you really care about science. So anyway, it's delightful to have this conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is for me, too. I mean, my undergrad is in chemistry, and then physics became a hobby and then an obsession, and, you know, one thing led to another, and a long bout with the oil and gas industry, I ended up with a PhD in physics. But,
wow.
You know, that, like you, opened up, you know, windows for me, and being introduced to my co-author, about 7 years ago now, she wanted to write a book on the creation of the Earth, which, of course, fascinated me, but she wanted me to do it from a physics point of view while she approached from the archaeological point of view. And what a match. So the rest is history. I got asked to do a radio interview and then got asked to host a show, and that was 4 years ago. So we're in good company.
Well, fantastic. Well, let's go back to your question.
Okay.
First of all, just a little bit about the basketball metaphor. You know, I use the metaphor in the book about what I call Michael Jordan's of the mediumship world, because I've had the privilege of now testing over 20 mediums who are, quote, the best of the best. And these are, quote, the superstars. And by the way, like Michael Jordan, they are anything but perfect. You know, Michael Jordan, as you probably remember, he averaged about 45% or so accuracy in terms of shooting. And on a good game, he might get 60% or so. And on a bad game, he might get 20%. And the question was, how could anyone who was missing more than 50% of his shots be a superstar? And the answer was very simple. All he had to do was to be better than everybody else and play by the rules of the game. And so,
and there was a little bit about leaving the ground at the top of the key. Even step on air and sink the ball. through a flurry of arms that looked like tree trunks. You know, yeah, he could do that too.
Exactly. And those kinds of dazzle shots are also something that superstar mediums do. They make these impossible shots from half court every now and again in terms of extraordinary accuracy. And we can give some examples later on. But anyway, getting back to your story, the question. The typical medium that I work with just looks like a normal person. They talk like you and I. They dress like you and I. They are often professional people. And when they are engaged in receiving communication, what they typically do is they will typically look away. So they're not staring at the person that they're reading. Quite the contrary, if you actually look very closely at their eye movements, you'll see that they'll move away, they'll get some piece of information, and then they will return their gaze if there's a person in front of them they can talk to. They will then point their eyes and look at the person that they're talking to. But when they're in the process of receiving, what they will tell you and what you'll see is if anything they're, quote, they're looking away. But if it's a dialogue process, now in our research, when we get to it, very often we didn't allow the mediums to even talk to the sitters or look at the sitters. So that process was eliminated. But but in the normal everyday reading, they'd look away, then they would, look back, you know, look at the person, then look away, then look back in this kind of a dynamic interaction.
So that's good to know. That's good to know because I kind of have, you know, these, dramatized visions of a medium kind of going into a trance and maybe holding.
Well, there is that kind of medium. There is what's called a trance medium, and this is a medium who will literally go into a trance, and then this person, instead of being as what's called a quote mental medium, will go into a trance, and then they'll literally be talking as if the deceased person is talking through them, as opposed to the medium having a conversation in their head with the deceased person and then sharing that conversation with the sitter, the person that they're reading.
That's a good distinction. Okay, we'll stick with that.
Yes, and by the way, also, I have done zero research on these so-called trance mediums. All the work that I've done has been with these so-called mental mediums.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned the term, you know, superstar. Mediums, and
mm-hmm.
I have to, we'll probably get into this in a few minutes, but I wonder sometimes about, you know, opportunity meeting preparation, where you have an individual who has a talent and they miraculously, it seems, become employed in that talent, and so thus, you know, they become a professional baseball player instead of a landscaper,
mm-hmm.
Or in a physicist, for that matter. In the few cases that the few mediums that you employ as test subjects in mm-hmm. your experiment called the Afterlife Experiment, you know, you've taken the best of the best, but there are probably you know, hundreds of thousands of wannabes out there who have been trying at it, and then those who are, shall we call them, the reluctant mediums. And
yes.
Before we get into that, I want to ask you, when you're interviewing the mediums and getting to know them, is there revealed a common age at which these talents seem to come out? I mean, it's not something that comes to them late in life. It's something that shows up early in life. But when?
Well, for many, not all. But I would, certainly the majority, are people who have had experiences when they were younger. They've seen deceased people. They've had precognitive dreams, meaning that they would dream about something that would then happen in the future. They would have various kinds of, quote, paranormal experiences. Very often, it runs in families. So it might skip a generation, but you very often find that that people who have the gift continues, which means that there may be a genetic component and or a familial component or a combination. Very often the mediums will not develop their skills when they're young, even though they have the capacity. They often don't develop it until they're older. In fact, often during the teenage years, it may even shut down during their when the hormones are raging and so on. And again, there are exceptions to that. The people who typically become really gifted, even though they have the capability, it requires tremendous practice, tremendous diligence. One of the mediums who I've tested three times in the laboratory before he became famous was someone by the name of John Edward. In fact, there was a recent show just a few weeks ago aired on the History Channel called The Brain, a two-hour documentary. And one of the 15-minute segments was on measuring brain function in people who claim to have psychic capabilities. And Dean Radin, who's a PhD, who has a bachelor's, by the way, in physics and engineering, a PhD in psychology, he was one of the scientists and talked about his research on what's called precognition and presentience. And the other person was myself with John Edward, because John had participated in an EEG brainwave study that we did in our laboratory that was featured in an HBO documentary called Life After Life. The important thing about this is that John will tell you, for example, that he spent years practicing at psychic fairs, learning what kinds of symbols were associated, for example, with what kinds of information, and developing discernment about distinguishing what was correct and what was incorrect. Besides reading everything he can get his hands on, he literally practiced. And the way that I sometimes think about this is that, you know, people become wine tasters, for example. It takes time to develop that kind of discrimination. Or people learn how to read x-rays. Again, that takes a great deal of training. There's a level of discrimination of perception. Mm-hmm. Well, the really skilled mediums seem to show that as a general rule.
Yeah, I can see that. And, you know, like Michael Jordan didn't walk on the NBA court, you know, a national or an international superstar. He not only played high school ball and college ball, but he played street ball until he, you know, became just a measure better than everybody else.
And same thing with Luciano Pavarotti or any of the great opera singers. They may have, you know, gifted and fantastic vocal cords, but they're literally practicing every day just to sustain their gift.
Sure. Well, so I guess this leads me to my next question. Is this something that someone like John Edward, you got to know him pretty well because you worked with him extensively, is this something he asked for, or did he just wake up one day and have this ability?
No, in the case of John, for example, he grew up in a family where this was not foreign to the family, and he had early experiences suggesting that he had psychic abilities. But as he tells the story, he actually had a reading at one point. I don't remember the details of this right now. It's in one of his biographies, and this psychic told him that that he was going to become a famous medium, and that he was going to become highly visible, and he was going to help bring the truth about this to the world. And he thought she was nuts.
Wow. Well, yeah, I think there are lots of, you know, reluctant mediums out there. I kind of think about the movie Star Wars, not the first mm-hmm. three, but the fourth one, when Anakin is this young boy and he uses his ability to see slightly into the future, which turns out to be a symbiotic relationship, but he uses this for pod racing. He's not a Jedi, he's not a great medium, he's a pod racer, but he uses right. that precognition to make a turn slightly before normal human reaction time would allow him to, and thus he survives. Right. And I wonder if there aren't, you know, sort of reluctant mediums out there who use the ability to communicate with the unseen or with the deceased to help them in their normal careers, in law, in politics, in engineering. I know I've been cast into the fire a few times as an engineer. Here, this piece of equipment was built by the last guy that worked here, and we fired him, and there's no manuals. Tell us how it works. I don't know how it happens. Gosh, you just start looking at it, and it just figures itself out for me. But, you know,
right.
Is this an ability that's innate to yes. all humans?
I think so. I think this is a form of information processing, accessing the information that just like any one of us can learn to play chopsticks, but whether we learn to play piano to any degree of accuracy or ever become a concert pianist depends on many factors, but we can all play chopsticks. We can all shoot free throws and get a few in. Okay, we all have this capability. The normal term that people use for this, the safe term, is intuition. And the different
okay.
people have intuitive or gut feelings. And if you talk to really successful businessmen or really successful lawyers or most great scientists, you know, they get hunches. They get their guidance. Things come to them in dreams. And rather than ignoring that information, they use it as part of helping them solve whatever problems they're trying to do.
Well, yeah, but they don't admit it until after they have tenure.
And not necessarily even after they have tenure. So they're very reluctant to come out of the closet about this.
Yeah.
And in some respects, I'm a rare person within the academic world about writing about these things, and then ultimately, and I do so in the God Experiments book, as you know, because you've read it, I literally share a little bit of my own personal experiences in, to see to what extent this applies to me too.
Sure.
So.
Sure. Well, yeah, you can't help it. I mean, gee, I now have this, you know, new ability to jump 20 feet, and I need to jump 20 feet. Shall I use it? when you interview a medium, and when you were trying to put together these, five or six remarkable individuals, and you're interviewing them, what do they say it feels like when they see?
Well, first of all, mediums tell us, that they often will have different kinds of sensations. Almost all of them hear, meaning they will hear voices or hear phrases or hear sounds, so to speak, in their head. It may even be very similar to their own thoughts, but what they'll do is they'll open to their and listen to words and phrases that pop into with their head. Some of them will have images. So in addition to hearing, they'll have images. They'll see pictures. These pictures might be in their mind, or in very rare occasions, people will literally see outside themselves. And you know the Sixth Sense movie, I See Dead People.
Mm-hmm.
I've met a few mediums who swear that they will see, for example, my departed adopted grandmother, Susie Smith, who wrote 30 books in this area. You know, they'll see her sitting in my desk chair at my office, for example, when we were having a meeting with these people. They'll literally see outside themselves. Most people have more visual images. They'll have feelings. they'll feel feelings of emotion that come over them when they're having a particular, talking with a particular person, and that feeling will then be, if you would, empathic, or expressing the feeling of the deceased person at the time. They will have bodily sensations, so they may feel a constriction in the throat, or they may experience a severe headache, or they may feel a pain in their back, and from that they'll infer that the injury occurred to the, you know, they had difficulty breathing, or they had a head injury, or they broke their back. So there are many different cues. Sometimes they'll have olfactory cues. They'll smell cigarette smoke, or they'll smell a particular perfume. And depending upon the medium, they may have all of those kinds of sensations.
Wow. Now, does this information always come from the dead, or does it come, you know, sometimes from the living or even the future?
Well, you really ask great questions. It doesn't come only from the deceased. And again, now what we're doing is we're referring to what the mediums report about their experiences. They will say first sometimes that besides getting information from the deceased, they will discriminate between the deceased and, for example, what they refer to as guides, which are other kinds of beings that they receive information from. And they clearly discriminate them from people who have been physically alive. Mm-hmm. They will sometimes pick up information, from the living, from a distant person. And very often they could discriminate between whether this is coming from a living person or coming from the deceased. They'll also get information about the future. And we'll see it as being in the future. But very often when they get future information, they don't know where it's coming from. They don't know whether it's being shown to them by their guides or whether it's being shown from a person who's deceased and now telling them something about the future. Very often they're confused about where the source of that information comes from. But they know it's the future.
Interesting.
Not always, but often.
Well, what about seeing events that have happened in a living person's past that no one could possibly know about? Is it possible that a medium could see an event in a living person's past without accessing the dead to do it?
They might, but then we wouldn't use the term medium, because the term medium only refers to when they're speaking to the deceased.
I understand.
Now,
okay.
If they got that information from the deceased about the history of the person. So if your deceased grandmother is showing the medium something about the sitter that happened in the sitter's past, then, you know, it's being mediated by the deceased.
I gotcha.
As opposed to, quote, reading the mind of the history or the energy of the person that's sitting in front of them. Now, one of the things, by the way, that is a deep scientific question, and it's something, by the way, that the skeptics will often ask, is when we've ruled out fraud and cold reading and radar bias and all the things that you have to do before you start considering anything, quote, paranormal, the first question you want to know is the medium simply reading the mind of the person that they're reading? So, you know, if John says, and I talk about this in the book, about how the grandmother's showing me that she brought daisies to the wedding, daisies to your mother's wedding, which, by the way, is a very rare thing for grandmothers to do to their daughter's wedding. And then later the sitter tells you that not only did her grandmother bring daisies to her mother's wedding, but she literally wove them in her mother's hair. So it was a very meaningful event. The question arises, did John get that by reading the mind of the sitter? Or was he getting it from the deceased? That's a hugely important question. And that's the so-called telepathy hypothesis, reading the mind of the living. And by the way, what the research suggests is that mediums are not very good at reading the minds of the people they're actually reading. They're typically not getting the kind of information that people are looking for or thinking about at the moment. They very often get information that the sitter has either forgotten or never knew in the first place, and they have to learn about by contacting other family members or friends, and sometimes they'll get information that no one knows, and is later confirmed because the information is verified by the finding of a lost object or whatever the case may be of that sort. And so, quote, mediums are, and as I said, they're not looking or paying attention to the sitter when they're actually doing the reading. That is on the information receiving side.
Well, it just seems like, you know, it's sort of like, you know, growing up in a family of bricklayers and discovering that you're a great violinist. These mediums, at least the ones that have made a name for themselves, have to have had some kind of path of reluctance. Maybe they started out getting precognitions or having telepathic events. Oh, I'm a telepath. Oh, I'm an empath. Oh, I have this talent, but I can't seem to classify it. And then they figure out, oh, I understand now that I'm actually speaking to the dead. I'm a medium. And so there's kind of this classification that they have to go through, and hence those who have not had some formal classification or some spiritual advisor to tell them, you know, here is where your real talent is, not only are they confused, but they are sort of a reluctant precog.
And yeah, I would have to actually say, I've been going through the list of the 20-some-odd people that I've now come to know well and tested extensively, who are clearly gifted in doing this. And I don't think I can think, I can't think of a single person that I've tested who wasn't reluctant, who wasn't seriously questioning whether they could do this, was seriously questioning whether they should be doing this, were not ambivalent about it.
Right.
And so on.
Yeah, boy, I have a lot of empathy with that.
Mm-hmm.
We usually take a break in it. We'll take a break in about 5 minutes. And,
okay.
Then we'll give everybody a chance to go to the fridge and whatever facilities they need to, and we'll come back. But a couple other questions before we kind of get into the experiments.
Sure.
Do the mediums ever report a malevolence to the contacts they make, or are they always benevolent?
That's a great question. First of all, mediums, that is professional mediums, typically do readings for people who want to hear from their deceased loved ones. So the people who come to their offices are coming to hear from people that they love and want to hear from. So they see a biased sample. They see a biased sample of deceased people, because typically people want to only hear from people that have been nice and loving to them. So that's the first bias. So the reason why, one of the reasons that you very rarely hear about malevolent spirits showing up in a reading is because The deceased who are hoping, I mean, the living who are hoping to hear from the deceased loved ones, these are not malevolent people. Mm-hmm. Secondly, mediums, as a rule, ask for protection. They ask for potential malevolent spirits to not only not be present, but they ask their, quote, guides and others to screen them out. They also typically do this work for the best and highest good, and they wish this to be safe for them and for the people that they're reading. And so they're building in potential protection and certain filtering of information.
Interesting.
And by the way, you know, people have asked me, could you bring in malevolent spirits, and is this kind of thing possible? And the answer, of course, theoretically, is once you become open to the idea, and the research clearly supports this now, the mediums seem to be able to speak to people who have passed over. That's what it's the most plausible and parsimonious explanation for the totality of the data. You then have to be open to the idea that the negative or malevolent, quote, spirits are there as well.
Interesting. Well, as we prepare, for the next hour, have you discovered in your experiments, at least from the medium's point of view, that this skill is easily controlled by the medium? I mean, what makes it come and go? How do they turn it on and off, and does it always work?
That's a great question. Most mediums are very concerned about that. So they practice meditation. Some of them dance. Some of them, John Edward works out in a gym and so on. I mean, people do things to gain control. So in the same way that surgeon wants to be able to turn his mind off by thinking about his patients and so on, or the lawyer wants to turn his mind off in terms of dealing with his or her cases, mediums, quote, can turn their mind off as well. And if you're not, quote, paying attention, because usually this information is relatively subtle. You know, it's quiet. You have to quiet your mind, and you have to go inside, and you have to be able to shut out distractions from the external world in order to be able to pick up these subtle cues. So it's very easy to, quote, not pay attention. On the other hand, there's a phenomenon called drop-ins, where a person will be in the shower or watching television or whatever the case may be, and all of a sudden, a deceased person will show up. And more often than not, they'll never have met this deceased person before.
Wow.
Okay, and, or they'll be at a restaurant, and all of a, and they'll meet somebody, and all of a sudden there's somebody's relative, you know, wanting to get through. And, by the way, it is recommended, that mediums not drink, and that they keep alcohol consumption to a minimum.
Right.
And the reason is because when you drink, people become disinhibited. And what that does is it makes it more difficult to shut off information that comes through.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I could see that. I could definitely see that. Wow, fascinating. This is going to be fascinating. All right, Earth Explorers, we're going to take about a two-minute break. No commercials tonight. Get enough of that in the Christmas season. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with more Dr. Gary Schwartz. Just thought it might be nice to listen to a little of the Portland Girls Philharmonic Choir, all girls under the age of 15. Welcome back to Hour 2 of X Squared Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Gary Schwartz, author of two books that I recently read, The Afterlife Experiments and The God Experiments, spelled G.O.D., How Science is Discovering God in Everything, including us. We were discussing in our first hour the mediums themselves, what kind of people they are, what kind of skills they develop, how they have to practice, and what kind of things, what kind of challenges they have to become the superstars that they are. Before we get actually into the experiments themselves, I got a couple more questions about the mediums. Because, you know, obviously we all have illusions of grandeur when we watch professional baseball or we watch rock music on TV and we dream of playing the guitar and getting on the stage and screaming for an hour and a half, or we dream of hitting a major league fastball over the left field fence.
Mm-hmm.
There are these dreams, these hopes that are in all of us, and those of most of us become part of the control group, which we'll discuss in a moment. but as we grow up, I mean, we play little league, we play high school ball, and yeah, there are talented people or people who are stars in high school and join the pros and never make it out of the farm team. How do the mediums cope with the skill as they grow up? I mean, do they put it on the shelf for a while? Do they struggle with it? Are they criticized by their friends? Are they encouraged by their families? How does one become a superstar in this sport of...
Yeah, that is a great question. Right now, by the way, there's no minor league or what do they call it? Little league. There's no mediumship little league. There's no grade school band or orchestra for mediumship. So consequently, this latent talent is not developed in most of us. If you could imagine from the moment before music was created and before instruments like clarinets and flutes and violins were invented, go back 5,000 years, humans didn't even know that they could play these instruments. These instruments didn't even exist. And in some deep sense, for most of us, we don't even know, other than every now and again maybe having a predictive dream or having a hunch that turned out to be correct or hearing some voices or seeing something that we couldn't explain, the latent talent that's there never gets nourished. So we really don't know how far this can go in terms of its development. Is it the kind of thing where most people learn to speak and learn to speak quite well, right? But they have to learn when they're young. We don't know if mediumship skills are like language capability, waiting to be developed, if the appropriate training was there early, or whether it's going to be more like becoming an opera singer, which is, it takes years and years of training to develop the voice, develop the vocal capabilities, to then learn the particular arias that need to be learned, plus the acting and everything else, and then ending up being a second-rate, opera singer. I mean, not being a superstar. The truth is, we don't know which it's going to be. Very, very, very few people become, Michael Jordan in this field.
Right.
And I don't know how much.
Look at the producers of American Idol. They made a fortune filming the folly of, singer wannabes.
Exactly. But singer wannabes at least knew that they had the potential to sing. We don't even hear at this point of people who are even trying to be mediums right now. And that hasn't reached that point yet. But my guess is it's going to be more like singing. Meaning, most of us can hum a tune, but you wouldn't want to listen to us. It would be in public.
Right. Well, I could see that, if this shows up in a young person,
right,
some unscrupulous parents might find an opportunity for wealth if they have such a child, like being able to win the lottery anytime they like. Seems like it would be a terrible temptation for fraud. Have you encountered any?
Boy, that is... Thank you so much for asking wonderful questions. No one has asked me that question before. And I do not know, by the way, of any cases. None that have been brought to my attention. And a lot of, as you can guess in this field, a lot of things are brought to my attention. And a lot of strange things are brought for me to consider. But I've yet to hear a case of a young child who was a gifted psychic where the mother was attempting to, or father, were attempting to, do the equivalent of the beauty pageant or have them become a gifted, pianist or chess master or whatever genius, and then even worse, doing this with the idea for less than the highest purposes. I have not heard of a case of that so far. But now that you've suggested it, maybe somebody on the air will get the
idea. Yeah, go see Billy. He's 11 down on 29th Street. You have to make a deal with his mom.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, that the telltale sign for me is someone who puts, you know, intuitive medium on their business card. That's when my defense is alerted. You know, the instant I detect that they want to use their skill. They won't use their skill unless they're paid money. You know, my carnival sense tells me to put my hand over my wallet and run.
Yes.
How many mediums did you go through before you found the ones who could really deliver?
Well, you know, I think, well, first of all, my circumstance was kind of bizarre because the very first medium that I met was a woman who was a housewife who was doing this on the side. She was not doing it professionally. No one had heard of her. She was brought to my attention by a professional, in this case a retired psychiatrist, and she turned out to be extraordinarily gifted. So the very first medium that I was brought to via a professional was even a woman who was interested in research. Think about how bizarre that was. And I then began, and I tell the story in the Afterlife Experiments book, I did a number of experiments with this woman and became convinced that she was not a fraud, she was not engaged in cold reading or anything else. This woman had, you know, much to my disbelief, had a gift. And then the reason why the other mediums became known to me and known to me quickly, and these were really gifted mediums, some of whom were already famous, was because the HBO was going to be doing a documentary on life after life, and they had heard through the grapevine that I was secretly beginning to do mediumship research. And they were interested in knowing whether it would be possible to demonstrate this kind of research on television. Then they told me that they had access to really gifted mediums, but many of them were reluctant to be on a television show because they didn't trust the producers, which is sort of understandable because the media tends to be very biased against this kind of work. What I suggested to them was, I said, look, you've got access to these mediums and you've got money. I've got a laboratory and ways to test them. Why don't we do the first ever multi-medium, multi-city sitter experiment under controlled conditions, sufficiently controlled so you could draw some sort of conclusions. Do it on television and then let the chips fall where they may.
Right.
And they had the money and they had the access to the mediums. So what happened was I went from one unknown medium, not a professional, to then four other mediums who were, at this point, functioning now as, quote, card-carrying mediums. But they had been, some of them had been doing it for 20 to 30 years. They were very well, some had books written about them, you know, and I described this in the Afterlife Experiments book. And then I had access to these people, and again, much to my disbelief, every one of them, you know, the other four that I tested, were as good, if not better, than the woman that I had been testing who was, this, again, unknown person. So I immediately, through good fortune, ended up being exposed to superstars. You see what I'm saying? It's not like I went out looking for mediums.
Right. I could see how difficult that might be, and running out of the New York Times, and you're
going to
be kidding.
It would end up being like, as you said, the American Idol. And I'd be in no position to have to weed through all the people who were, at best, so-so. Or frauds.
Right.
By the way, because, you know, people always ask me, they say, gee, Dr. Schwartz, are you trying to prove survival of consciousness? And I say, absolutely not. What I'm trying to do is to give survival of consciousness, if it exists, the opportunity to prove itself.
There you go.
My job is to just design experiments that are carefully controlled but sensitive enough so that if there's a phenomenon, the phenomenon will be revealed. Okay? That's my job. And the way I tell the mediums to people who come to the lab is I say, look, if you participate in this controlled experiment, and if you do well, if the data are good, I'm going to defend the data, and therefore I'll defend you. On the other hand, if you do poorly, and if I catch you cheating, I will also share those data, and I will expose you. And so when people know that the data are going to be shared no matter what, you know what that does? It discourages the people who are not very good, and it certainly discourages the frauds, because we make it impossible to cheat.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you did talk about one who was, you know, sort of an amateur at it, although relatively gifted. Did she survive in the roster of medium subjects?
Well, I think you may be referring to actually a case where these Chinese scientists brought this woman who claimed to have been tested, who was not a medium, but claimed to be able to read information with her fingertips. There was a protocol that they used. In fact, she was tested by someone who did his PhD at Stanford and was teaching it at some university in I think it was Hangzhou. This woman came to the lab, and we did a series of tests with her, and she looked, on first glance, to be real. And then we brought her back for more controlled testing. We videotaped her from multiple angles, and it turned out that we actually discovered that she had been very subtly cheating. She had fooled the Chinese scientists. But she didn't fool us. And we had to ultimately expose her. And I published a report documenting how she had tried to fool us and how we had uncovered her cheating.
Wow. Pretty good at sleight of hand.
Oh, yeah.
Well, have any of the mediums told you about times when their ability wouldn't work or that they couldn't turn it on when they wanted?
Not only that, we often witnesses in our experiments. And in the book, the Aflac experiment, I give examples, for example, with John Edward, where he'll literally say, I can't get anything for this sitter. Literally, he gets nothing for this sitter. And he'll get a zero. He may end up getting information for another sitter who's not even in the room.
Oh, yeah. But, we'll talk about that. That's a really neat anomaly, and I love anomalies in experiments, and I would definitely want to talk about that.
Okay.
But what do they say it feels like when the lights go out, so to speak?
It's just blank. Either, quote, nothing will come, or they're being distracted by their emotions. I mean, one of the ways to not get information is to become stressed, anxious, frustrated, emotional in any way, shape, or form. So if you want to have a medium perform poorly, stress them, activate them emotionally, get them angry. And what that happens is then their emotions, their feelings are stronger than the things that they're searching for. They're then flooded with their own thoughts.
And the more skilled ones are good at telling the difference between the noise and the
good ones are also good at turning off their own feelings and getting into a quiet, boring state. That's why the good ones all meditate. They all practice meditation.
Do they have a difficult time socially dealing with this extra sight that is so rare? In other words, are they recluses or do they have active family lives?
First of all, most that I've met, and again, I see an unusual group because I see the really visible ones. I see the ones who are interested in research. I see the ones who are not afraid to be tested or, as John Edward says, be in the hot seat. So I see, again, a selective group of people. Having said that, these people are not recluses. They are active family people. They're active in television. They're interested in their careers. They are interested in service, they write books, so on and so forth. They're professionals. They may even be social workers or hospital administrators or teachers, okay? There are some, however, who are, they become, unfortunately, caught up in being a star. You know, they end up, their egos get the better of them. you know, because they're in the limelight, and the issues of fame and become distracting from their original calling, and that's one of the challenges. I mean, anyone who becomes in the limelight, you know, has to be careful of that, whether it's a politician or a religious leader or a scientist or or a medium.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's not uncommon with superstars. I mean, look at Dale Strawberry. I was watching an interview with the coach of the Dodgers, Tommy Lasorda, and the interviewer said, "Is it true that Dale Strawberry is a dog?" And you know, Tommy Lasorda said, "No, absolutely not. A dog is loyal and will run hard after every ball."
I got to tell you the story.
Okay.
You brought it up. I wrote a book called The Truth About Medium. And in this book, I put together research and as well as clinical case studies of a diverse group of mediums, many of whom didn't like each other. And I knew that because I would hear the stories about one disagreeing with the other and so on. And I wanted them to sort of feel comfortable about being in the same book, and also help the reader understand that, you know, that mediumship is, it's not just a warm, fuzzy community of people. And I use the metaphor of saying that in my experience, my sense is that mediums are more like cats than dogs. And part of, you've heard the phrase herding cats.
You know? Exactly.
And, you know, some cats are soft and purry, and other ones, you know, they're just very feisty and so on. And anyway, when I said this, some of the mediums said to me, boy, did you nail us, you know, and they said right on. Others were so offended and that they hissed at me for using the metaphor that they might be like cats. And I said in the book, I loved cats. At that point, I had two adopted cats. You know, it's not anti-cats. I was just describing.
Well, the implication that, you know, hear kitty kitty has to be associated with the sound of an electric can opener before it runs. You know, I could see it would be offended.
You know, let's get to bring up dogs. I had to bring up cats.
That's funny. So, well, you say in your book that, you know, even supermodels have their bad hair days. You know, when in search for superstar mediums, how were you able to convince them to become part of your experiment?
It's really interesting. Well, in the early days, it was very difficult. In fact, with the HBO special, Life After Life, two of the mediums, one of whom was John Edward, the other was Suzanne Northrup, which I described in the book, they were very reluctant to participate in the Life After Life show because they didn't trust them. And they grueled me. Now, you understand, these are both New Yorkers. They're tough people. But I also grew up in New York, and I could be tough if necessary. And what swayed them was when I used the Michael Jordan metaphor and told them that they didn't have to be perfect, that they'd have good days and bad days and so on, that I also knew that they knew a lot, just like Michael Jackson, Jordan knows a lot more about basketball than I do. They know a lot more about mediumship than I do. So the first part of, you know, it's up to them to sort of show me what they do and how they do it. And they have to be, help me, they play a critical role in, quote, literally the designing of the experiments so we can optimize giving them the opportunity to show that they could do. In fact, you know, I gave the example in the book of saying, you know, imagine that Michael Jordan comes to be tested by some scientist and this guy's a skeptic and he says, okay, Michael Jordan, he says, look, he says, if you want to be tested in my lab, he said, in my lab, you're not allowed to jump. Well, you know, if Michael Jordan's not allowed to jump, you're never going to be able to show that he could make extraordinary baskets with his jumping capability. And so you have to start off with allowing them to demonstrate what they do and how they do it, but playing by the rules of the game. No cheating, no cold reading, you know, the normal things that you have to rule out. And that's what led them to realize that I wasn't just that I was going to be fair. I was going to listen to them and let them prove themselves.
Great. Well, I could see where the genuine ones would would value the opportunity to show their stuff. I mean, I know exactly. Michael Jordan's going to say, what do you mean, not jump? I mean, my middle name is Air, Peter. Okay? So yeah, I can see where you're going to give them a chance, and they're going to show their stuff, and then you're not going to secretly have another group of debunkers and naysayers who are filmed at a separate location, and then you're going to edit the film together and make the typical History Channel documentary.
No. In fact, as you know, I tell the story a true account of how that kind of thing could be done with the media, and how you have to be very cautious of which media you work with, because if somebody wants to prove that not only is Michael Jordan can't play basketball, but not only that, there is no such thing as basketball. What you do is you show Michael Jordan making air balls, missing shots. You show Michael Jordan, for example, fouling, because on occasion basketball players foul.
Sure.
You don't show the dazzle shots or the extraordinary things. And if you just show the negative, people get a one-sided view, and they'll come to the conclusion that there is that Michael Jordan's a jerk. You've got to be very careful.
It rings? What are you talking about here? In the film. All right, well, we've got a pretty good picture of the mediums, and we're going to meet them individually as we go through the experimental data. Now, let's talk a little bit about the other aspect, the other factor in this design of experiment, and that's the sitter.
Right.
What were you looking for in the sitter?
In the sitters, and by the way, as the experiments went on, our criteria for sitters became ever more rigorous. But what we wanted from the sitters were, number one, they had to have had they had to have had one or more people who had died, obviously. Secondly, they had to have had close relationships. We were interested in there being some possibility of an incentive for the deceased to wish to speak with the living, and also for the living to want to speak with the deceased. So there had to be some reason for communication to be present. Because remember, you want to optimize the conditions for getting an effect. The people had to be willing to be scrutinized under controlled conditions and to have their ratings carefully evaluated. Like in the earliest research, literally every item from a given reading would be read out loud to the sitter after the reading. They would then have to rate the item from -3, which is a complete miss, through 0, meaning I don't know, to a +3, which is a complete hit. They then had to justify their answer, explain why they were giving the rating that they were giving, and then they had to indicate whether there was any living relative or friend who could confirm their information. So they were going to be, they weren't just filling out questionnaires. They were being rigorously examined so that we knew whether or not they were going to be, how accurate they were. They had to be willing to spend the hours and hours of scrutiny to do this. Also, they had to be willing to be tested under blind conditions. So they had to be able to follow the willing to do the research, meaning that they had to be, not know who the mediums were going to be. There were various kinds of conditions that had to be met so that they would, you minimized or eliminated the possibility that they could be in collusion with the mediums.
Right. Now, just for the listeners, because we're not approaching this arbitrarily, these are real conditions for the scientific method.
That's correct.
You need metrics, and so you've got the -3, probably -2 and -1 as well.
Exactly.
+3. So you've got 7 different levels that you can rate each one of these answers, and that helps statistically evaluate the data and do metrics.
Yes, in fact, in our case, the 0 was, I don't know, could be yes, could be no. A +1, for example, was a possible yes or a possible fit. A +2 was a probable fit. And a +3 was a definite fit, meaning yes, that applied to my deceased loved one. Mm-hmm. And then there was again -1 is it possibly doesn't fit, -2 is probably didn't fit, and -3 was definitely didn't fit. And in the research that we actually published, we only counted as hits plus threes.
Ah, right.
So only the direct hits to be counted. Anything less, we treat it as a miss.
Right, that's good.
We're using a very conservative of scale here. But in addition, we were really grueling these people in terms of, well, how do you know this information? We wanted to make sure that they weren't just, you know, grasping at straws, or they had to really justify their answers. And in the later research, it became even more grueling, because the mediums, the sitters had to not only rate their own readings, but they had to rate the readings of other people's as if it were their readings.
I gotcha.
So in one experiment, for example, we had in the third experiment, which is called the Canyon Ranch experiment in the book, there were three mediums and five sitters. So each sitter was independently read by three different mediums. So they had a total of three readings that were then going to be transcribed, and they would have to score item by item. But in addition, we required them to score the other 12 readings, all the other readings, as if they were their readings, to see to what extent was the information general, you know, could apply to the other people. We wanted to see how specific the information was. Now, that's a huge amount of time and work.
Sure, sure.
Well, these people have to really be committed to being participating in the research.
It sounds like rigorous treatment of the data, too, which is good and should be respected in the scientific community, which is hopefully what we have tonight. I do want to let you know, I know there are a lot of callers out there, and we're going to hold the calls just for now. We'll open up the phone lines in the third hour, so go ahead and get your questions written down. I'm sure they will change as we go through the program, and I know a lot of you want to talk to Dr. Schwartz, especially about, you know, maybe your own circumstances, but let's hold off just a little bit longer. I want to get into the terms of the experiments, and then you can at least understand the scope and the breadth of what we're talking about here, and hopefully pick up his two books, The Afterlife Experiments and The God Experiments. By the way, tell our listeners how they can go ahead and get these books beside, you know, the normal.
Sure. Well, if they want, I mean, the simple way is they could go to my website, which is www.drgaryschwartz, that's D-R, Gary, G-A-R-Y, and then Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z.com, and that has links to the books that will take them to Amazon.com to purchase them. But they can get them from any of the major, you know, booksellers.
Right. All right. And I got mine from Barnes & Noble, which has always treated me well as an author and as a customer, so patronize them if you want to. So let's talk about the control group really quickly. You used students at Arizona University. Did any of those show any propensity, or were they all just average like most of us?
Well, that particular control group, we've used different kinds of controls in different experiments. In that particular control group, we wanted to know the following question, and that is, to what extent could people spontaneously guess this kind of information?
Right.
In other
words,
how much could just, you know, by just sheer guessing, could you get this information accurately? Because we didn't have any base rates. So we took a group of, I don't remember the exact number right now, but it was, I don't know, 70 or 80 more undergraduates. They were given a whole series of items, and they were then asked to guess what the answer to this information was that was related to the given sitters, to see to what extent could people guess as accurately as the mediums did. And it was very striking, because their rate of accuracy of guessing was, depending upon the individual, anywhere from 20 to 40% or something like that. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, compared to the mediums, who were getting over 80% accuracy in that particular experiment.
That's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. And so what this was telling us is that simply just trying to guess the information is not going to be the explanation for the data. And so if the mediums didn't have the information ahead of time, meaning that there was not fraud involved, if this was not information that was just vague and general information that the sitters, the mediums were giving, which of course it was not. I mean, because we went through the details about names and specific initials and causes of death and historical facts and personal descriptions and so on, and categorizing the information and looking for specificity of information. So if it was not fraud involved, if it was not what's called the cold reading or simple magic tricks or fake mediumship techniques that are used, and then if it's simply not guessing, and if it's not rate or bias, then you're left with, and it's not experiment or error, we're led to entertain the idea that something called paranormal is going on.
It's more than statistically significant because the control group was given questions that were generated by the mediums themselves. The mediums didn't have a list of questions that they had answered. They just started blank.
In fact, one of the things that led to the next generation of experiments, from the first experiment, which were the HBOs, to the second one, which was called the Miraval experiment, because it was conducted and funded by the Miraval Resort, which was in the Health Resort, which was in Tucson, was that one of the mediums, and it was Suzanne Northrup, introducing herself, and in this experiment, by the way, they were separated by a screen, and the only answer that a sitter would give would be yes or no. Suzanne Northrup, started by saying, Papa God, Papa God, indicating that the father was deceased. And then she just talked for a few minutes and rattled off a whole bunch of things that she was seeing about tobacco and lung cancer and belt buckles and all these different kinds of details. And it turned out that over the course of the reading, she only asked 5 questions.
Really?
Only asked 5 questions. She generated over 130 or more pieces of specific information. And the accuracy of her information, in terms of specific information, was over 80%. And what this told me was that the medium didn't have to talk to the person to get the information. And that's what led to the next experiment, where the first part of the experiment, not only couldn't the medium see the person, but they weren't allowed to talk to them. So they couldn't ask any questions.
Wow.
They had to just, sit down in the room, and they would be told that there was a sitter there, and then said, okay, what we want you to do for the next 10 minutes is to get whatever information you can from this sitter. They didn't know if the sitter was male or female, young or old, black or white, didn't know anything about the deceased loved ones, and they just had to talk with no feedback from the sitter or the mediums. And although that's more difficult for the medium to do, they could do it, and they get accurate information. And it's not, and guessing doesn't give you that.
Well, let's talk about the first round of experiments. You're putting together a design of experiments which has to withstand what you imagine to be the rigors of criticism that you're going to get, and that's sometimes hard to do when you're putting together something that's never been done before.
Right.
You had 5 mediums, and
right.
How many sitters did you have?
In the first experiment, there were 5 mediums and 2 sitters.
Okay. And how did that go? I mean, just give me the highlights who were the 5 mediums.
Okay, well, the 5 mediums that are described in the book, they were John Edward and George Anderson and Laurie Campbell and Susan Northrup and Ann Gaiman. There were 2 sitters who happened to be both female. One of the sitters, by the way, was selected by the HBO producer. And this was a person, by the way, who had at least 6 deceased loved ones within a 10-year period. So there was a possibility of multiple deceased persons coming through, because each medium was going to read this sitter. The first time a sitter was read by multiple mediums to see whether information could be replicated across mediums.
Mm.
A very novel kind of thing to do. And the reason for the medium, for the producer selecting the sitter, was so that the experimenter, which was me, I would be kept blind. Right? Because we don't want the experimenters in cahoots with the mediums. However, of course, course, I didn't know if I could trust the producer. So what I said was, okay, you pick one sitter, I'll pick the other sitter, and you'll be blind.
Right,
The sitter is. And if the sitter that we pick, that I pick, is as, the information is as accurate as the information of the one that you pick, then I know that, I haven't cheated, and therefore I can infer that this is not some sort of collusion between the production staff and the mediums.
Yeah, they didn't sow some kind of virus into your, experiment. So how did it go? I mean, John, who was first? I think it was,
I'm trying to remember this one. It may have been Suzanne Northrup. It's been a while.
Right, Suzanne
Northrup. But I'm not sure. The way this experiment worked was, it was in some, and the book explains this, that each experiment became ever more rigorous. That is, as I learned what mediums could do, I then began making it more and more difficult for them to do it. Sort of like letting Michael Jordan, for example, just play like he normally plays, and then having him only be able to go 20 feet from the basket, and then only being able to shoot with one hand, you know, and then eventually blindfolding him and seeing if he could shoot without his eyes. You know,
by the way, Mike, there are four other guys on this team, okay? So.
Right. You got it. It was actually funny that there were five mediums, because it was a basketball team. That's what, isn't basketball five players?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if I remember correctly?
On the court at any one time,
right, okay. Most. Anyway.
Sometimes one doesn't show up. But,
yes. And in this experiment, there was a screen separating the medium and the sitter. Now, this experiment was even more complicated because we recorded 19 channels of EEG, brainwaves, from both the medium and the sitter simultaneously, and also recorded both the medium's and the sitter's EKG. So I was running two computers simultaneously, one for the medium and one for the sitter, of their brainwave activity while the reading was taking place. I mean, it was
there any kind of synchronization that occurred in the brainwave activity between the two?
Well, what's really interesting is that the, if the mediums were so-called reading the minds of the sitter and reading the energy of the sitter, what you'd expect is that as the reading went on, there would be increased synchronization between the electrical activity in the medium and that of the sitter. If, however, the medium's hypothesis is correct, which is they're not reading the energy of the sitter, if anything, is a distraction. What they're doing is reading the energy of the deceased.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, what you'd expect is a decrease in the synchrony between the electrophysiological activity of the sitter and the medium when the medium is doing the reading. And that's what we found.
Really?
Yep.
That's profound.
Isn't that profound?
Yes, that's amazing.
It's amazing. I would love to be able to replicate that kind of and extend that kind of work, but the EEG research at that level is significantly more expensive than, for example, doing telephone readings. And by the way, we've had virtually no funding for this kind of research, except through private donations or through television shows wanting to do this kind of work. I mean, you know, NSF, National Science Foundation, is not going to support this research. The NIH, National Institutes of Health, is not going to support this research. So one's very limited in what one can do, and you have to sort of take advantage of opportunities when they arise. But anyway, getting back to the experiment, after a baseline period, the reading would take place, and the medium was allowed to ask questions. So she was allowed to say, for example, is your father deceased? You know, or whatever. But the sitter was only allowed to say yes or no. And that was the minimal amount of interaction that was allowed. And as we said, the future subsequent experiments decreased the amount of interaction that was enabled in the experiment.
Yeah, I can see that. I vaguely remember the John Edward, program, that was on, I believe it was HBO. And he had a room full of participants / spectators, and he would just walk out in the middle of the room and start streaming this data, and it would apply to someone with whom he had no idea in the audience, and it would somehow fit together and make a program. But in this case, there's one sitter, one set of information, and it's, I mean, when the cameras start rolling and the recorders start recording, it's showtime. And, you know, let's go ahead and talk about the differences between the mediums, and then we'll talk about the similarities, and then we'll move through the experiments, because I do want to talk about the God experiments, and then in the third hour make an extrapolation from that, which I'm sure you've thought of, but I didn't find it in your writings. Suzanne made a contact with the sitter, and then what did John do? John came with more specific information?
Well, what's really interesting is that each of the mediums replicated certain information. So, for example, and some of it was kind of silly. Like, for example, all of them said that there was a deceased son. None of them said there was a deceased daughter. And it turned out there was a deceased son, and she had daughters, but her daughters were not. None of them were deceased at the time. Mm. So even just by that simple little binary, you know, statistic, you're getting consistency. Three or four of the mediums described that the death was sudden. John Edward said that the medium went out with a bang, and George Anderson said he killed himself, didn't he? And it turned out that this young man actually had shot himself.
Wow.
And you know, first of all, it could have been a male, could have been a female, could have died from any number of causes, including drug overdoses or cancer or car accidents, you know. And by the way, John later indicated that he sensed it was suicide, but he didn't want to mention that on television, because really all of this was being videoed,
mm-hmm.
for being aired on television. In addition,
what about the names of individuals? I mean, they didn't know the sitter or anything about them. That was part of the blind conditions.
That's correct.
Did any names come up?
Absolutely. In fact, I don't remember all of the details in front of me here, but if I remember, three or four of them came up for the son with the initial M, and one or two of them may have said Michael. And it turned out, you know, they could have said any initial, right? And if it was an M, there could have been a Mark, for example. And it turned out that the boy who dies, his name is Michael. So there was a lot of replication of key information. Also, there were surprises that was also replicated. I think it was four of the five mediums came up with the fact that there was a deceased dog, and they described the dog with great accuracy. And it turned out that they did have a family dog. It was very close to the son.
Now, that's amazing. I mean, a lot of people think that, you know, humans are, you know, the only sentient beings that move on with some kind of intact intelligence. But to think that, you know, pets do this as well, or was it the deceased memory of the pet that came through, or was it actually the pet?
Well, two of the mediums, in fact, I loved it with Suzanne, she actually saw the dog going over to the sitter. You know, walking around and she couldn't see through the screen, but going to the sitter. And at one point, Suzanne says, "The dog is back. The dog is back." I mean, just, so they're literally seeing these pets. Now, if you remember when we first started the show and you asked me how did I become open to all of this, and I shared that it started with physics and astrophysics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what led me to become open to the idea that our memories and our consciousness and our histories was preserved in the, quote, vacuum of space in the form of photonic vibration was because, you know, that's the basis of astrophysics, that light continues and all the information continues. And that idea that information and energy of living systems continues in the, quote, vacuum of space is not specific to humans.
Right.
It applies to any living system. So theoretically, whatever consciousness a dog has, or a cat has, or a horse has, or a parrot has, or any creature has, its potential for its history to be preserved is just as great as yours or mine. That's just simple physics.
Well, that's true, that's true. And if it's, you know, photonic activity to realize that those photons are not propagating not, you know, locally, they're propagating non-locally and can be accessed. But
exactly.
in that access, there is effect on the photons.
Yep.
The spin is altered. Once they're observed, a photon can collapse into a particle or can be annihilated altogether. So there is an observation effect to be considered as well.
There is an observation effect, but what's beautiful about all of this, and think about this, is that when a starlight starts sending light, it sends light out in all directions. And although the light may bump into, obviously, physical objects from meteors through other planets and stars, most of the space is empty.
Sure.
So there's tremendous redundancy, if you would, holographic, if you would. And therefore, that you have, you're never going to eliminate all the information. In fact, once it goes out there, there's no way to get it back, in the sense of ever making it all go away.
Right, right. Yeah, so be careful what you do or don't do, because it will affect
exactly.
the universe.
You start thinking more about the kind of, you take a longer view, much longer view.
Indeed. Yeah, sort of like the Book of Life being written.
Right. Now, but one of the things that was really interesting about this research was that besides the specificity of information and the stuff that was replicated, and although I don't go into this in great depth in the book, was that there was also a storyline. It was as if the second reading took off where the first reading left off. So, because we had all five mediums and the lab at the same time, and they weren't being tested at the same time, but they were all physically in Tucson. And since this is very expensive to do this, you know, because they were doing this as a TV documentary, you know, we ran one medium after the next, after the next, after the next, and so on. What you could do is chart and see whether or not each reading started in the same place. And there was actually an unfolding of information that simply it carried over as if the journey was continuing. Now that's a much more sophisticated kind of, if you would, narrative analysis as opposed to sheer replication of core information that was occurring over time.
So you're sort of creating a psychic echo, and it is being strengthened by the deceased themselves, who now have a pathway or a medium.
Well, imagine that you are the deceased. Okay, well, let's imagine that you are Michael. Do you think you want to repeat your story five times to a medium? I mean, if you're actually going to talk to your mom and you're participating in an experiment, you know, you're going to want to continue the conversation.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So there's some incentive for this conversation to continue, like you and I are continuing the conversation.
Well, that being said, the first experiment, although by itself a raging success, also revealed experimental weaknesses in the design. So you designed a second experiment at Miraval.
Right.
And so...
Now, by the way, we were aware of those weaknesses right off the bat.
Ah.
It's not like we weren't aware of the possibility of tone of voice of the sitter might be important.
Mm-hmm.
Or feedback from the sitter might be important, and so on. It's just that if you're going to start doing this research, again, remember the Michael Jordan metaphor. You start off trying to do something sort of like what mediums do. You see whether these is anything even worth investigating. And then what you do is you add more and more controls. So in the second experiment, we added some critical additional factors, and my favorite was the one where we broke the session into two parts, where the first part of each reading was what we call the sitter silent period, where the medium was not allowed to ask any questions, never heard the sitter's voice. The experimenter was not talking to the medium. So it was just, okay, medium, give us whatever information you can. No feedback whatsoever, no tone of voice, nothing.
Wow.
And the question is, could you still give accurate information? And we had four mediums in that experiment, and we had 10 sitters.
Ten? Oh, my goodness.
It was 10 sitters. And the data that were analyzed in great depth was a surprise. One that was, for me, as remarkable as the five words that changed my life, that opened me to the possibility that this was real.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because what happened was, the woman who had been tested five times, the primary sitter, her name was Patricia Price, after the reading, those five readings, and all of the hours of the scoring, the data, and so on, her husband, who had been extremely skeptical, all of a sudden realized that there was something real here. His mind changed as a function of what his wife experienced and the research that was done. And then what happened was, just before we were about to conduct the second experiment, he was killed.
Really?
Yes. And the idea occurred to us that since in this experiment, the first part of the experiment, the sitter never even heard, the medium never even heard the sitter's voice, we wondered what would happen if we could bring her back and have her be read again, but the mediums wouldn't know that there was now a new deceased person.
Mm.
And the question is, would her now deceased husband show up in addition to her son? And we were able to actually do this with two of the four mediums. In the book, it was going to be described as John Edward and Suzanne Northrup. That's who it was. With one of the mediums, we couldn't do it because the morning of the experiment, she actually saw in the mirror the deceased husband of the sitter from the previous experiment and asked whether something had happened. Isn't that bizarre?
Wow.
So we ended up, it was immediately confounded, so we didn't even test her with this one particular sitter. And it turned out that during that that completely sitter-silent period, both John and Suzanne got information about the deceased husband. And what was really bizarre was they talked about how, for example, that the father was met by a son, because the son actually died first, which of course, as you know, is pretty rare.
Right.
But secondly, at one point, John said, "This doesn't make any sense to me, but I'm hearing Michael times two, Michael times two." Now, why that's important is because not only was the son's name Michael, but the son was actually named after the father. The father's name was Michael as well.
Now, these readings can get a little precognitive in the sense that in the first experiment, this is the same sitter and obviously the same medium, although John had access, at least by voice, to the sitter,
right,
Pat, in the first experiment. Her husband was alive at that time, and he had made a comment that the son was making comments that he was preparing to meet the father.
That's correct.
Like,
and at the time that happened, in the first, in the first experiment,
mm-hmm,
I just thought that, John was, John, he's like Michael Jordan. He's not perfect. He makes errors. And that was one of his air balls. I never thought that there was actually a possibility that in this case he was having a precognitive or seeing information about the future. That's
now,
correct.
Did Michael Sr.'s behavior change at all prior to his passing, or did he just take him by surprise?
I know that he... Well, that's a really good question. I can't give you an answer to that. What I can tell you is that he became a believer, and he started when he used to drink at bars, and he rode a motorcycle and so on, and he was, sort of a lower middle class guy, very nice guy. And he would tell people about how his life, how he had this, transformation, that he was all of a sudden seeing the world in a new way. But whether or not there was anything that he was doing that increased the probability that he was going to die or not, I don't have any information about that.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, did he make comments to Pat that, know, for instance, they had an anniversary coming up and she was trying to make plans, and he said, well, you go ahead and make plans and I'll try to make plans to be there. I can't be sure.
You know, I don't even remember if I wrote about that in the book. You would probably know better than I would, but I don't recall.
Okay. I just remember reading in the book that she had said, at least posthumously, that, you know, gee, he had made some comments that...
I do remember that. Yes, you're now reminding me. Just by the way, for your listeners' sake, I thought we were only going to be speaking about the God Experiments book tonight.
Oh, that's okay. So, that's okay. We're going to get there. I just want
If you want to do another show on the God Experiments, it's fine with me. If you want to just focus entirely on the F5 Experiments, but getting back to you, to the question about this research, as remarkable, and by the way, John and Suzanne's accuracy was again extraordinarily accurate for this new reading, and they were very shocked to find out that it was. Later learned that it was actually Pat. However, one of the problems we pointed out in this particular experiment was that these sitters had come from various parts of the country. They had even come from Hawaii, and they left having not with the promise that they would fill out these detailed item by item questionnaires, mm-hmm. and we couldn't get them back. It was not possible to get the data scored. In any great depth, save for that one particular, well, two of the readings that we were able to do, because the subjects were close by. And so, when we designed the third experiment, which was even more sophisticated, which we can talk about momentarily, one of the criteria was that all the sitters had to be in Tucson.
They had to all promise
that they would actively, do the scoring. And they knew that they were going to have to do it in front of me, so that I was going to make sure that every sitter scored every item. Because remember, these people are also volunteer; they're not getting paid for this.
Right, right.
The mediums weren't getting paid. The sitters weren't getting paid. Of course, the experimenters weren't getting paid, and so on.
Well, it's good that everybody came together for the love of the data, and we will discuss. What was discovered, and I don't want to get so much into the details of the readings because you could read the books for yourselves to get that. But the proof of the experiment, the hypothesis, is what's important tonight. And where we go in this third hour, we always go a little past the imagination of the listener. You're going to be surprised. You're going to learn maybe something about why we're here, what we're doing here, and where we might be going. We'll take our second break. Again, no commercials. You're getting enough of that out there in the TV land. So we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Welcome back to hour three of X Squared Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Gary Schwartz, author of The Afterlife Experiments and The God Experiments. You can pick him up at his website, drschwartz.com. I'll give you an Amazon link and you'll learn a little bit about the research. We're glad you're here tonight. Take a little break from commercial Christmas shopping out there and join us. We are talking about not only the perseverance or the eternal existence of the soul, but we're also talking about mediums and their contact with these souls, and then sitters and control groups that have come together for a marvelous experiment. And I didn't want to avoid the book The God Experiments because there's some important data in there about the observation effect on particles, random number generators, random electron generators, and the idea that the human consciousness, mortals, even though we are eternal beings having a mortal experience, it seems, have an effect on what we would normally consider inanimate energy out there, and that we remain organized beings after we pass from this world, and we don't necessarily, well, as is evidenced from the last 2 hours, break the ties with the mortals, with our family connections or even friends here on this earth. Welcome back, Gary. How are you?
I'm enjoying hearing your questions.
You know what's amazing about this program? It lasts for 3 hours, they say. But we go through this stuff in about 15 minutes. It just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think in order to do the God Experiments justice, we may have to do this again, perhaps next month when your schedule opens up again. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the program. I am going to go ahead and open up the phone lines this
sure.
hour. So if you want to call in toll-free, U.S., you can reach us at 888-228-4494. Canada, we also have a toll-free number for you, 877-489-6350. And if you're like me, with free nights and weekends on your cell phone, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-776-5154. If you're using Skype, just reach us at bbsradio.com. If you want to reach us with Pal Talk, it's just bbsradio. I'm sorry, it's bbsradio_com for Skype. And go ahead and give us a call. Ask Dr. Schwartz any questions that you may have about his experiments. Now, one of the things we like to do in this third hour is we sort of jump off from all of the data that we've collected now with the interview, and we go somewhere that perhaps you may have in your notes. It may be on the editing room floor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know you've had some thoughts. I know even those that have participated with you, either as producers or writers or editors, have also had these thoughts, that we have perhaps irrefutably in the last 2 hours established that not only does the deceased remain in intelligence and memory and concern and love, a strong connection between that and the sitter, the living, and that mm-hmm. they do use mediums to come through to these sitters, because the mediums have refined their skill and remain a pure window or a conduit, an opening through which the deceased can speak to the living. And the one aspect of the experiment we haven't discussed yet, and we want to discuss this hour, is the deceased themselves, that they are no longer mortal. They're not mediums. They're not the control group, and they're not the sitter, but they're definitely a component in the experiment.
That's right.
So how does the deceased view themselves? Do they view themselves now as an eternal being and lamenting mortality, or are they looking forward to the next phase of their development? And have they recalled experience or information before they were mortal this time, with this name, Michael, John, or Susan, or Ellen, or whoever it was?
Well, I should ask some really interesting questions. First of all, there's different levels of research, and I promise I'll address the question. The first kind of research is, quote, is there an afterlife? And
right.
what kinds of experiments you need to do in order to really draw a firm conclusion. And our latest experiments are, they're what I call triple blind experiments. The details are not important. But the research just keeps supporting the idea that this is a real phenomena. The second question is, well then, if there's an afterlife, what's the afterlife like? What are people doing? What are their experiences? What have they learned? How have they grown? How do they interact with us? You know, why are they still here? What have they learned that they can teach us? So on and so forth. That kind of work is in some respects, of course, much more interesting, and in a deep respect also in the long term more important. It's also more controversial because most of my, in the academic world, the university world, people are either relatively unaware or don't believe the findings from the research thus far. And so therefore, if I were to start sharing with them, and I will share publicly with you momentarily some examples of this, that not only are people's grandmothers and mothers and sons giving us information about what it's like on the other side and how they've grown and so on and what their memories are and the like, but also, and this has not been made public, although the book that I'm currently writing, which is called The Spirit Experiments, confesses this. There are great luminaries who have been coming through multiple mediums who have information to share. And they include famous scientists, and they include famous personalities, and so on. And only now am I being brave enough to actually, if you would listen from a content point of view, because you have to rule out the biases of the mediums and what they think is happening so that you can rule in the conclusions that people are hearing. So for example, I'll just set the stage for this. In the Truth About Medium book, I actually talk about research where the late Princess Diana was involved, and how she became and the story about how I ended up doing meeting a woman who was actually a very famous health reporter for the Sunday Times and other newspapers in England, about how it was that she ended up being a sitter in experiments and how she had connections with and known Princess Diana when she was alive and so on, and how I ended up validating that the continued presence of Princess Diana and some of the things that she was sharing since she passed. That was one of the first times where I was forced to start thinking about what can people from all different walks of life teach us. So the questions that you ask are deeply profound, and although our evidence is less definitive, there are certainly lots of if you will, hints and suggestions about what's unfolding. So why don't you ask me question by question, if you would, and then I'll give you answers as we know.
Here's what's driving it. You mentioned in the first hour that, you know, great musicians developed, and over time, better and better instruments got developed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of, you know, someone who has such a powerful creative personality who doesn't get to reach their zenith in a mortal lifetime. For instance, I could imagine some spirit saying, violins? They have violins now? I was beating on an animal skin stretched between two sticks. I never got to, what's violins? Come on, I want a chance at that. And so, you know, these powerful entities, these spirits who do exist, we now know this because of your experiment.
Mm-hmm.
The term coming through, do they only have access to mortality through mediums, or do they get the chance to break through into a fetus or a child and live another mortal lifetime?
Okay. Well, that's the so-called reincarnation hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And let's address that hypothesis. Okay. There are cultures that have, you don't believe this for thousands of years, that if you would, metaphorically, there's a recycling of souls, and we keep coming back, learning more lessons, developing more skills, and so on. So as humanity evolves, individual souls evolve, and people can go back for hundreds of lifetimes. Okay. There's also the belief that after a person dies, their soul continues, but in a spirit form. And so they don't, quote, reincarnate. What they do, though, is they continue, if they care about it, they continue to grow by remaining connected, if you would, to the Earth or other planets. And they do so not just through mediums, but through, you know, participating in the physical world as spirits do. And the question is it an either-or? But that's a big question. Is it an either-or? And the conclusion that I've come to, which is actually, in some respects, it's kind of novel, is that, think of the following. Imagine that we begin with the premise that our energy and information is like the light from distant stars. It continues, including in its organized form, long after the star or our bodies have died. And that the question is, what's the probability that all that information and energy, the essence of who we are, that history can be gathered all up and squeezed back into a single cell? All the light that's going in all the different directions. Well, that seems pretty improbable. So the idea that you could take everything that you were and put it back into a single, you know, tiny little biological system is improbable, not impossible, but probable. However, what's more probable is that you could seed, just like we have sperm and eggs, we could seed a new being so that the core of who we were could continue in another form. And therefore, we could, quote, reincarnate. And yet, simultaneously, the essence of who we are could also continue in the spirit form. So, in other words, instead of it being survival of consciousness versus reincarnation, it could be survival of consciousness and reincarnation. Now, why is that an interesting hypothesis? Because it helps explain, among other things, certain bizarre claims in religion. As you know, a very influential being whose birthday, you know, metaphorically, because it's not actually a physical date, but we celebrate Jesus' birthday, we call it Christmas. And people all over the world celebrate his holiday, his birthday. And in Earth years, it's now 2008 years since he was born. Now, Jesus, quote, died a long time ago, over 2,000 years. However, people all around the world claim that they pray to Jesus, and many people report having the experience of Jesus coming to them, of Jesus saving them, and so on. Now, if these people are not just simply hallucinating, this is not just all in their head, then you're left with the puzzle. You're saying, gee, could Jesus be around for 2,000 years? Well, the answer is, why not? You know, starlight could be around for billions of years. Jesus could certainly be. He was a very powerful personality when he physically lived on the earth. There's no reason why he couldn't have even developed more power since he's passed. Our research clearly indicates that people who are bigger than life in this life are bigger than life in the next, and they come through very powerfully. So if they were strong, dominating personalities when they were here in the physical, they're strong, dominating personalities after they've physically died. And also, what our research suggests is that, I put it affectionately this way, it's much easier to multitask after we've died. So, you know, I could be right now, for example, you know, talking with you on the telephone, and simultaneously thinking back to when I was a professor at Yale, and looking out, being out in my backyard in Guilford and looking up at the stars. Now, I'm physically located in Tucson right now, talking to you, and in my imagination, I'm thinking that I'm in Guilford, Connecticut. But in the spirit world, literally it's possible to do two things at the same time. Literally, you could be in two places at the same time. You can imagine these things, and the effects seem to be that way. And there are all kinds of examples where evidence consistent with this has occurred. So imagine for the moment that Jesus could be present in hundreds or thousands or even millions of places at the same time. Simultaneously, what the Bible says, is that if you bring Jesus into your mind, if you adopt Jesus' ideas, if you pray and commune with Jesus, then Jesus can, quote, live on in you. And therefore, you can take on qualities of Jesus, including healing abilities, so on the surface, and so forth. And therefore, it's conceivable that someone like Jesus could literally be reincarnating multiple times, and even occurring multiple times simultaneously, and also simultaneously be a 2,000-year-old, you know, more experienced, up-to-date, internet-savvy Jesus who is interacting with us in the present. And although those ideas may stretch our, you know, minds beyond where we normally go, it's actually not inconsistent with what contemporary physics would allow.
Well, I understand that, and that's a good example. Let me offer a couple more.
Please.
Because Jesus is well known and well written about and well revered and certainly has no small number of religious followings complete with songs and film. But who or what was the musician that inspired Beethoven? What was, you know, what is a Clerk Maxwell doing now? Where is Einstein?
Right.
Where is Da Vinci, who was obviously
right.
well ahead of his time and in tune with something well more engineered than his precursors could have been?
Exactly. And here's a big question, and I want you to ponder this. Let's take, you know, we hear of child prodigies, where they know much more and receive much more than they could possibly be figuring out. It's as if they are, you know, having muses. Well, there are two interpretations here. One is that, you know, a famous skilled musician has now reincarnated in them. The second possibility is that the famous musician is collaborating with them. So that it's not that the person, it's not that Beethoven is reincarnated or Einstein is reincarnated. It's just that Beethoven and Einstein are each resonating with and collaborating with new beings on the planet. And the question is, how do we scientifically determine which of those two hypotheses are correct? Or whether both of them are correct?
Well, it could
be. From a scientific point of view, right now, we have no evidence one way or another. It's one of those great open questions for the future.
Right. And that brings me to the quantum physics of it, I guess, and that is that, you know, physics being this curse of a hobby that we have,
mm-hmm.
we look at the arrow of time the same, whether we're looking backward or forward. Mathematically, it's identical, that everything is basically non-local, mathematically speaking. So the idea that there was no Beethoven before Beethoven to reincarnate as Beethoven, but there may certainly be now. In the future, there are great talents that have already figured out things that we are facing now as problems. And so those, shall we call them sensitives, or those with whom these strong personalities resonate with, they're going to pick up that information and perhaps bring the solution at the right time instead of too late.
Yes.
And maybe that's what we're seeing. You know, these are all maybes, but, you know, the first 2 hours we established that personalities, these obviously existing mortals, because they've got family members with whom they interacted while they were mortal. They had progeny. They had, you know, motorcycles that they rode and worked on.
Mm-hmm.
There's proof that they were here. And sure. Now there's proof that they're there.
That's right.
So if they exist in the future, then perhaps they existed in the past.
And that we have to be completely open to that possibility. But yet at the same time, there's a continuity and evolution in all of this. Imagine for the moment that the beings who were, if you would, these extraordinarily strong beings whose life was knowledge and whose life was advancement of the human species. Let's assume for the moment that their commitment, their love for humanity and the earth doesn't simply end just because they die and their bodies are no longer in the physical form. As I affectionately talk about in the Truth About Medium book, this woman who's participated in multiple experiments since you passed. Susie Smith, I affectionately say, Susie has given new meaning to the phrase, our work is never done. So let's say that we have missions that continue, and our passions continue. Then, theoretically, these beings would very much like to be able to share their wisdom and knowledge and increased abilities now that they've passed with us. It's just we have to be ready to listen. But up to now, we haven't set up, a formal way for them to be heard, because most of us aren't listening, and we don't have any formal programs to give them the opportunity to provide us with this guidance.
And as you said in the first hour, there is no medium school.
And there is no medium school, exactly.
Right.
By the way, since you're open to physics, I mean, one of my fantasies, and it's not my fantasy, I mean, there are many people who ponder this, is that to the extent that we're dealing with ultimately, you know, what we call photons and what we mean by the quantum fields and so on, and that what we call matter is organized energy, so on and so forth, then it's not inconceivable that someday, just like we have cell phones, that we're going to eventually have, you know, for lack of a better term, I call them soul phones, which are going to be technologies where you and I will be able to talk with Einstein, or be able to talk with Sir James Clerk Maxwell, or speak with any being who's willing to pick up the phone and have a conversation with us. And therefore, our capacity to be able to receive wide guidance and to have a collaboration between here and there will be dramatically increased. And, you know, there was a time that there were no airplanes, and now we take air travel for granted. There were a time that we had no cell phones, and now, you know, we take cell phones for granted. So it's not inconceivable that it's just a matter of time that our technology and conceptions will sufficiently expand so that, quote, the veil will be broken, and it will be just as easy for any one of us to have a communication with quote, someone who's died, just as easily as you and I are communicating right now.
Wow. And hopefully we have enough people with visions out there of living in harmony with the planet, so to speak, or
yes,
maybe even reaching out beyond what we can reach with a titanium can in space.
Mm-hmm.
To someplace even further and more enlightening than our own heliosphere.
Right. By the way, speaking of the idea of being able to travel, quote, to distant planets and galaxies, when we're in the physical form, we have to, so to speak, drag our body with us. And so consequently, there are constraints on, you know, how fast matter can travel in certain forms, so on and so forth. But if we're in a non-physical form, if we're in a quantum field, energetic form, you know, some people have speculated is that we can go from quote here to there as quickly as we can think. You know, that if I want to go to the moon, I think about being at the moon, and the speed with which I think about being at the moon, my consciousness could now be at the moon. In other words, the whole idea of space and even time preventing us from being places, that constraint may be removed.
Oh, yeah.
When we leave the physical form. And therefore, what we call extraterrestrials could be extraterrestrials who have actually what? Are actually deceased. And the reason why it's not difficult for them to travel around the universe is because they don't have the constraints. And then what they're doing is they're then rematerializing, if you would, as if they're reincarnating metaphorically.
Well, lest we should all seek, you know, premature disembodiment in order to get this privilege, keep in mind that it takes a tremendous amount of energy and organization to get here, to have a mortal experience with which to carry forward and give you this kind of contrast. This kind of limiting extra senses that come with it, and the ability to smell and see and love and have pain and disappointment and also success and imagination. Mm-hmm. So don't seek to end it too prematurely, and don't think that this is over by any extent. Now, one of the things that you bring to mind is when you ask people in physics experiments, one of the things that we use a lot are postulates, and one of the postulates is, what's the definition of space? Well, space is void with the presence of energy or particles.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take someone to the edge of the universe with their imagination, and then you ask them, now, what is beyond the edge of the universe? Well, they immediately thrust their imagination beyond the edge of the universe. And then I tell them, you know, technically, you have just created space, because you've put your energy out into the void, and now you've created space. You've expanded the universe with your own imagination. So be careful what you observe.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, in the God Experiments book, which we'll save for another time, I have a whole chapter about research conducted at various laboratories, including Princeton and at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and some research that we've done in my own lab on the effects of mind on quantum phenomena, and doing this at, you know, at distance. And once you begin to realize that consciousness can literally operate, you know, in, at the fundamental levels of physics, and do them at distance, you know, the power of consciousness becomes even more inspiring.
Right, and it's not just imagination, because you have data. You have
exactly,
you know, random number generators, which statistically produce a normal distribution of numbers, now observed by what you call an absorbed mind, and now it's not, the mean is shifted. It is now a different set of numbers.
And yes, and these numbers are actually being generated by electron, quote, noise in an electronic circuit. So you're dealing with numbers that are, quote, random, that are being measured by the behavior of electrons in the Josephine junction. So it's a very interesting, you're dealing with mind in the quantum world.
Yes, exactly. And it kind of brings me to maybe the concluding four or five questions here. The deceased, which maybe to their frustration and to the vacuous loss of the living, have been trying to get a hold of their living counterparts, wives, children, cousins, whatever, grandchildren, without success. And now they're provided a way to communicate in a physical way through a medium to their counterparts. Have the deceased now been affected by that experience?
Wow. By the way, no one has asked that question. And you know what's interesting about it? It's scientifically addressable. And by the way, I'm publicly announcing that you have raised such a profound question/hypothesis, that in the future, I don't know when it's going to happen, it's a year or 2 years or whatever, but in the future, we're going to test your hypothesis. And it will be named after you. Now, let me just tell you, here's the idea that popped into my head. A dear friend of mine, for example, recently died. He died a week ago, Saturday. The week of Saturday. And I've had one reading with a really gifted medium.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's come through, okay, and evidential information was reported, and some of it I have yet to confirm with his wife, because it's not time yet. But anyway, imagine now that deceased person A has had his first reading with medium X, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now what happens is, deceased person A has a second reading with a new medium, medium Y, who is blind to medium X. And now medium Y is asked questions to see to what extent does the deceased person A indicate information about the previous reading and changes in his potential consciousness or feelings or relief or and so on. In other words, what the mediums tell you, John Edward talks about this a lot on his television program, about how when we in the physical send love and caring and thoughts to people who have died, our love for them gives them energy, gives them support, gives them love and so on, and plays a role in their lives. And what's interesting is, one could verify that, and you've proposed it, and we're gonna test your hypothesis.
Well, you know, people have asked a question from time to time, not to make this too religious sounding. Does God really need our glory? I mean, we're told to glorify God in song and prayer and, you know, praise Him and all that, but not to make light of it, but do we really understand the principle, the power, the energy of glory? And what you're talking about here is one person, albeit mortal, sending love, sending which is a powerful high frequency energy, mm-hmm. to someone who has passed away.
Right.
It is going to be received by that person that has passed away, and you've just said give them strength, hope, give them realization that the living is not grieving so badly that they can't carry on with life, and you're okay and I'm okay and we're all gonna
right.
Going.
You know, it's really interesting. I'm now being reminded of, if you would, anecdotal information that is consistent with your hypothesis. For example, mediums have said to me, when my mother and father will spontaneously show up at a reading or whatever, they'll comment, for example, about how, my mother's here and they give some evidence of information, and they'll say that my mother's very proud. That she's very, that she's both, surprised and proud of what I'm doing, and she's reinforcing me for doing so, okay? Now, what's interesting about this is, if what I'm doing in the physical right now is bringing joy and comfort and happiness to my deceased parents, then I'm continuing to bring, to be doing something useful for them, even though they're not here. And the whole notion of that, and I hear stories, for example, of the deceased learning from their children who are now still in the physical. And that it's, that there's an element of excitement. We recently, just coincidentally yesterday, did our first trial run of recording EEG using a relatively new state-of-the-art EEG brainwave system that allows you to see the analyses that are taking place in real time, so you can actually see what's happening in the brain. And we had two different quote psychic mediums silently receiving communication from beings on the other side. And I asked each of them afterwards, and by the way, their brains were visibly then different, and different in very interesting ways, which is encouraging and is going to lead us to, obviously, to do this research in a very formal, systematic way. But what was interesting was that each of them, one of them said that their quote guides and others were so excited that we were doing this kind of research, that it was bringing great joy to them, that there was an enthusiasm for the next stage of this research. And again, implying what? That what we're doing is having an effect, on them, with them.
And thus that realm.
And thus that realm, exactly. And the idea of actually verifying that scientifically is frankly something that I never thought about doing. And it's your fault.
Well, anything that we can do here, I mean, we can even, I know Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who started Noetic Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's anything we could do here to help, you know, raise some funding to get this data collected, analyzed, and treated and published so that, you know, perhaps the living, perhaps we can walk up to the precipice and not walk over it, because as we've already alluded to tonight, the deceased have some precognition, albeit, you know, we don't know how far in the future they can see, but it's logical to assume that they could see the cliff that we don't see, because we're locked into the linearity of time, and they may not be.
Right. You know, in the God Experiments book, just as a prelude to the potentially doing this in the future, the first two chapters deal with a gentleman called the Dream Detective from England, Christopher Robinson, and who sees the future in his dreams. And we did this very, very well-controlled, remarkable experiment where I ended up being, as you know, forced to the conclusion that he was the real deal and that there was something very profound taking place. And one of the things that was very interesting in the, which we never formally tested in this research, but was something that he claimed, was that the reason that he was able to not only use his ability to catch terrorists, specific terrorists, and also prevent certain kinds of crimes was because deceased policemen would come to him and would give him information about the future that he himself couldn't get. So in other words, it was in his dreams that the deceased were providing him with assistance in seeing the future that he himself couldn't see. So this whole notion that the quote other side has certain capabilities that we don't have is again one of those things that actively needs to be formally tested.
That's remarkable.
And celebrate.
I'm recalling some writings that I read last year of Nikola Tesla, who, you know, made no bones at all about telling people that his ideas about energy and electricity and the relationship between man and the earth came to him in dreams, and all he really did was build it. And you know, when I went to Tibet a year ago and I saw a stupa, which is an instrument, I guess, built by the Tibetans to commute the soul of a Panchen Lama through a four-dimensional stargate, it was a Tesla coil, but it was built in the 7th century.
Wow.
So when you overlay the two, you see that maybe the two of them got information from the same source, but Tesla knew how to build it with electricity, and the Tibetans built it with gold and jewels. But
right.
It's interesting that perhaps the deceased, frustrated in their unfinished business, are able to pass their unfinished business along to the living and get it finished.
It's a lovely thought. You know, that one of the things that your audience should know is that normal, quote, normal people, any of us, can potentially receive there's a whole area of what's called afterlife communications, or after-death communications, ADCs, and that, and Diane Archangel, for example, wrote a beautiful book about examples of very systematic data collected about people's evidence for various kinds of after-death communications after their loved ones die. And some of this includes physical phenomena. It's very common, for example, that after a loved one dies, that there are electrical anomalies take place in one's house. Lights go on and off, TVs go on and off, computers behave anomalously. There are these erratic changes.
Gary, we do have a caller on the line.
Sure.
Let's go ahead and get that in, and then we'll finish the thought. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Ramon from New York.
Hi, Ramon. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Fantastic.
I have a question.
That's a great question. What the mediums will tell you is that the process of communicating with a deceased person is a telepathic one, and that it's no different in communicating telepathically with a deceased person and communicating telepathically with a living. In other words, telepathic communication is telepathic communication. The question is, to what extent are mediums more, if you would, adept at telepathically communicating with the deceased than with the living? Now, one difference in terms of the telepathic communication with the deceased is that the deceased are actively trying to communicate with the medium. So it's a two-way process. With a living person, typically, the sitter, for example, is not trying to communicate telepathically and is not able to typically, if you would, consciously read the mind of the medium. So it's more of a one-way process than a two-way process, if you can understand that distinction. We did some preliminary experiments where we literally had mediums try to telepathically read the mind of the sitter versus communicate with the deceased.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they were able to communicate telepathically with the living was to get assistance from their guides.
Oh, how about that?
Isn't that amusing? And when I told them that was cheating. So that, and then when they when what?
No, I'm talking about that thing, for example,
Yes, it would be like having an operator not only connect you, but also having the operator serve as the link between the two.
Yeah.
So you're talking to the operator, and then the operator's talking to the other person on the other end of the phone.
Right. Right. Like she says to tell you this, Ramon.
Exactly.
Okay.
I don't understand why we've never practiced more on the telepathy, and I feel if we did, the advancements consciously would be, I think, enormous.
I completely agree. You just reminded me. I once had the privilege to test a number of identical twins who actually not only believed that they were in telepathic communication, but the few that I tested actually practiced it as a game. And much to my great surprise, when I formally tested their ability to communicate telepathically, they could actually do so.
Wow.
When you did the experiments, did you have a EKG on them?
No, in these experiments there were no physiological recording. The twins were in two different rooms, and then I would show one twin, for example, a novel photograph, something that they'd never seen before, that had unique features, and they would describe what they were seeing in the photograph. And then the other twin, of course, who couldn't see the photograph, and obviously couldn't hear what was going on in the room, would then attempt to describe what she was getting telepathically from the twin. We got positive results.
What I've always thought about telepathy is that the way I, and this is my personal belief, I haven't been able to test it, the way it works, it's almost like if I'm trying to send a telepathic communication to you gentlemen, then my brainwave would fall into your brainwave pattern, almost mm-hmm. like finding the telephone number.
Right.
And that way, I'm able to communicate.
Yes. One of the things we talked about earlier in the program was that I had the privilege to do one experiment where I was able to record the EEG of both the mediums and the sitters, brainwaves simultaneously as well as their EKGs, to see whether or not the mediums were actually reading the mind of the sitter. And what we discovered was, which was actually consistent with what the mediums claimed, was that when they were doing their mediumship, i.e. when they were attempting to communicate with the deceased, they actually became desynchronized or less synchronized with the sitter, implying that they were actually disconnecting from the sitter, and therefore, in principle, connecting with energetically, and therefore you would think synchronizing with the energy of the deceased.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from, Ramon, the ability to send a thought to someone else and have them pick up on it and have validation that that thought has been picked up on is well proven. I've witnessed it in my own life, and I've certainly read enough publications about that to know that it can be done. And it doesn't have to happen real time. You can send a thought out, and it can be acted upon, a week later by that person. It doesn't have to be a real time synchronization. So, and I want to add my support to that thought too, as well as Gary, that the world would be a better place if we could perhaps have medium schools and maybe even telepathic schools, so that while we're getting schooled in the art of speaking English, we can also get schooled in the art of the mental communication between one another.
By the way, in earlier times, before all of this technology, when we lived in nature, before books and before musical instruments and all this kind of stuff, it's very possible that our ancestors were much more in communing telepathically and tuning into the energies and intentions of animals and so on, because they were not distracted by all the things that we're distracted by, and they literally put their consciousness into communing more intimately with the energetic signals around them.
No argument here, and certainly it would have been easier to find a quiet mind in those quiet times than now. But given my druthers, I take now over then.
Me too.
Ramon?
I just have one more.
Okay, go ahead.
One more comment, and then I'm going to go off air. I just feel that as far as like communication between other species that probably speak completely different languages and vocal tones and other beings that may not be in the physical form, whether they be deceased or never became physical, I would think that the best way of communication would be telepathically, because then you don't need a language. Because if I came on right now only speaking Spanish, then probably the gentleman wouldn't understand what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you would. I don't know if you speak Spanish or not. But example.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think one of the things that mediums do is they actually pay less attention to the words, and they pay more attention to the intention behind the communication. And I remember when I had this experience of I learned a little French, and I said hello, bonjour, hello, bonjour, hello, bonjour, hello, bonjour, over and over and over and over again. So finally, to think hello was bonjour and vice versa. I didn't have to translate. And one of the things that happened was, once I did that enough times, all of a sudden, the intention of greeting, the intention of welcome, did not equal the vibration of hello or the vibration of bonjour. What it was the intention, the meaning behind it, which is universal, which is welcome or greeting. And if you start paying attention to the intention as opposed to the code, then you get past the language barrier and even the species barrier. And I think mediums, the really good ones, get into that kind of mode of, if you would, intention communication.
Very interesting. Enough information for another program. Ramon, thank you for the
call.
Thank
you, gentlemen.
As always.
Thank you,
Ramon.
My guest is Dr. Gary Schwartz. His website is drgarschwartz.com. We'll have the link on our website. My thanks to you, audience, for being there, and many millions of you who will hit this site over the next week to listen to this great interview. And my thanks to you, Gary, for coming on, and I look forward to having you on again.
Well, thank you. As I wish to most genuinely share, it is such a privilege to have someone who actually cares about both the science and the theory and the meaning and the significance of this, you know, these kinds of challenging questions. You're fun to interact with.
I appreciate that more than you know. You have a great holiday season, my friend, and we'll talk to you later.
You too. Okay, blessings.
Bye-bye. Eric the Explorers, that is it for December 7th, 2008. Please remember. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people. Help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth Explorers.